Our first case for this morning is the case of Howell against Motorola, which has been consolidated with the case of Lingus. So, Mr. Mills.
Good morning. I represent Bruce G. Howell. He was the original plaintiff in this case, and he is the appellant on the release appeal, which is the 2007 appeal. When Mr. Howell was laid off by Motorola, he executed a certain paper called General Release. It appears in the record at page 8256, and it says, and I quote, "I understand by signing this release, I am not releasing any claims for benefits under the Motorola employee benefit plans." The claims that he has asserted here is that his 401k plan balance, an employee benefit plan balance, was less than it should have been because the plan was mismanaged by fiduciaries. We know that that is a claim for benefits under the employee benefit plan. We know that from a number of authorities, including this court's opinion last year in the Guyton case, said that rather clearly a claim in a case of this nature, whether it's that the fiduciaries absconded with the 401k balance or they just mismanaged it, it's a claim for benefits.
Mr. Mills, I think this case, Mr. Howell's case in particular, in part the other as well, requires us to cope with two things. Number one, how do we reconcile the language that you just read from the general release with the language that appears about five lines earlier, saying that the release includes but is not limited to any claim or entitlement to pay benefits, et cetera, under the Employment Retirement Income Security Act. So that sentence is there, and then there's your sentence. And then the other thing I think that we've got to grapple with is LaRue, basically. You cited LaRue in your reply brief, and that was the first time it was available to be cited. But LaRue holds that 502A2 does not provide a remedy for individual injuries distinct from plan injuries. You seem to be arguing that your client might also be suing for the plan, and LaRue seems to preclude that. But LaRue also says that 502A2 does authorize recovery for fiduciary breaches that impair the value of plan assets. So those are related questions in that you need to address, I think, whether such a claim can be released, how you think we need to reconcile these two parts of the general release that your client signed.
Well, I think they can be reconciled. The carve-out language, which I read, is specific and I think controlling. The more general language would encompass any number of other types of ERISA claims. Just by way of example, there's a provision in ERISA, I believe it's in Section 510, and it basically says you can't fire someone to prevent them from claiming their vested benefits.
But why is that a benefits claim under ERISA? The earlier language says that it includes benefits claims under, among other things, ERISA. The word benefits is right there. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down from the top of the release.
Right, and it's also qualified by the prior line that these are claims which could have arisen out of either employment or separation from employment. I think what the general language is dealing with is signing away rights that basically you're being fired and you want to raise a claim later for gender discrimination, which is one of the provisions, or age discrimination.
Or, as they say,
510, because your benefits are about to vest. Those are the kind of things that I think are covered by the general language, whereas the specific language that I've read would seem to me to be, you know, the specific and the controlling.
What should we do, in your view, if we decide that this release is hopelessly ambiguous?
Well, if it's ambiguous, it would seem to me that you would go to the rule of ambiguity being, you know, drawn against Motorola, the drafter of the document, I would think. But I think my reading of these two provisions, I think, is a sensible one.
Now, your opponents.
The way Motorola. I'm sorry, Judge.
I was going to say, your opponents have argued that the general language that is in the middle of the paragraph relates to things like arguments about the plan, I suppose, and they're saying that just by releasing Motorola from those claims, he's not releasing any benefits that have already vested, but trying to dig below that isn't covered. At least that's what I think they're arguing.
It may be. I don't. It's an interpretation. I don't see anything in the record that would support that. I think if you read the language as broadly as Motorola did, you would get some obvious absurd results. Let's say this case is about mismanagement of plan assets. Let's talk about theft. Let's make it a theft case. Some fiduciary steals Mr. Howell's account balance. It's a 401k balance. Could be $50,000, $100,000 or more. Can it really be said that in signing this paper in exchange for 2 weeks' release, he knowingly and voluntarily intended to sign away the right to sue if somebody stole his balance? That, if you read it Motorola's way, that's the conclusion. I don't think that's an acceptable conclusion. Whereas, if you read it the more narrow way, the way I'm reading the controlling language, what I call the controlling language, I think you reach a sensible result. Because this is about a 401k plan, I think most employees think of a 401k plan balance. It's almost like another bank account.
But I have another issue with this. I mean, you're trying to say, on the one hand, that I guess his theory is that the amount of money in his own part of this plan, so defined contribution plan, is less than it would have been if Motorola hadn't engaged in all of its deals with this Turkish company. But clearly, I'm a little bit worried that your theory, your underlying theory of the case, means that all of Motorola's business management of where it decides to invest its money, who it decides to loan money to, what equipment it decides to sell, suddenly falls under the fiduciary provisions of ERISA. It's the only reason the Motorola stock plan didn't return as much as people like Mr. Howell were hoping, was some question of bad business judgment, really.
The investment is either prudent for a retirement savings account or it's not.
But you've disclaimed a theory that they just should have deleted the Motorola stock plan.
No, that hasn't been disclaimed. I know they say that in the papers. There's nothing to support that. I think we addressed that in the reply brief.
I'm trying to think, actually, what's the remedy Mr. Howell would get if you were to prevail and we were to send this back for further proceedings on the basis that the release doesn't bar everything? Where does this case go?
The recovery goes to the plan.
Why?
That's LaRue, and especially the last words of LaRue.
Doesn't LaRue preclude that? I'm looking at LaRue.
I think it's right at the very end, Your Honor, Judge Wood. I think it might even be in the last footnote, if my memory serves me right. But it's where the Supreme Court said, if there's a recovery here, and of course we're not reaching that, the recovery does not go to the participant. It goes to the plan. And it just reaffirms what a claim under Section 502A2 is all about. The recovery goes to the plan, and in this case, the recovery would go to the plan and then through the plan to the individual accounts that lost money because of the malfeasance.
I don't see that. Well, one thing that has occurred to me, particularly since your opponents did not have the opportunity to submit any detailed consideration of LaRue to this court, is that it might be helpful for us if each side were to do that. Do you think that would? I think if you in 2 weeks could submit supplemental, just simultaneous, I don't think there's any need to have a response and reply and all that, but simultaneous briefs on how you think LaRue affects your case, I would appreciate that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Mills, are you contending that Section 410 of ERISA prevents your client, Howell, from settling any sort of claim he might have for mismanagement or imprudent investment?
Your Honor, the answer is yes. This admittedly is not the strongest arrow to the release argument. The first is the carve-out language, and the second is the knowing and voluntary standard, which I'd like to address in a second. But basically, The law, this court I don't think has had occasion to consider 410A. Some other circuits have.
A lot of cases have, though, in other circuits.
Well, yes, but the real distinction, as I understand it, under the, especially the Lynn case in this circuit, is what Mr. Howell claiming a pension entitlement, or is it a claim for pension? And I'm not sure to this day whether that's exactly so. I just don't want to, you know, concede my rights while this court hasn't yet addressed the 410A issue.
And so part of your argument is that he got 2 weeks additional severance pay in exchange for this release, and that's just nowhere near comparable to what he could have gotten in his ERISA action.
Yes. Yes.
But that's what settlement's about, isn't it?
If it could be settled, Congress wrote what it wrote in 410A. It said it's void against public policy. Exactly what that means, as I say, this court I don't think has yet passed on. But if we know that pension entitlements can't be signed away. We know that. Is this a pension entitlement as distinguished from a pension claim? I'm going to argue that it's an entitlement. Quick word. We also win on release on the knowing and voluntary. All of the evidence in the record pointed that Howell did not knowing and voluntarily release his claims in this case.
Okay, if you want to save your rebuttal time, that would be fine.
I would. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll first take a stab at trying to reconcile the language that Judge Wood was discussing in the release agreement. It is defendant's position that the practical intent of this language clearly was that while all disputed claims were to be released and waived, Mr. Howell would not be giving up his undisputed right to collect a pension when he reached retirement age, to draw down the balance of his 401k account as shown on his quarterly statements, and so forth. The way we reconcile this language is that the claims that are released are claims or entitlements to pay, benefits, damages, et cetera, arising under federal law, including ERISA. That would be disputed claims, including, in this case, the statutory breach of fiduciary duty claim. But he's not releasing his claim to benefits under the plans. Now,
you know, the only problem with that, Mr. Murray, is that this release doesn't quite say that. And I have looked at this language until it's inside out, and I'm really having trouble. And it's not just your fault. I was actually asking myself the question, how, in light of what the Supreme Court has done to you in LaRue, would you draft a release? Or is it possible? Maybe it's not possible. But LaRue seems to collapse 502A2, 502A3, I mean, the lines that made sense for defined benefit plans are much harder to apply with the defined contribution plans.
I think that's right, Your Honor, but I think the important thing to remember is that this is not a claim for benefits. This is a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. If the plaintiffs prevail on that claim, it is possible that one of the results will be that their benefit entitlement will increase. But the claim is fundamentally not a claim for benefits. Claims for benefits are brought under Section 502A1B of ERISA, and those claims are preserved by this agreement. That's not what the plaintiffs have brought here. They've brought a statutory claim for breach of fiduciary duty. And Harzuski versus Guidant doesn't change that result. It merely says that there's still a sufficient connection with the plan because of the possibility that down the road, if a fiduciary breach claim is resolved in their favor, they may have more benefits coming to them, that they aren't out of standing. That's all that Harzuski does. So we would distinguish this sharply on the basis that the claim is not a claim for benefits, and therefore it is not preserved by the language preserving claims for benefits.
Isn't that a little artificial if his ultimate recovery would be better benefits under his defined, the difference between what a prudent investment would have yielded and what the imprudent allegedly inclusion of the Motorola plan yielded?
I don't think so, Your Honor. This is a claim for breach of fiduciary duty that has an incidental impact or an ultimate impact potentially on the benefit, but the benefit would still have to be claimed and paid out. he has to first establish that the 401k account, quarterly account statement that he gets is wrong. And that's a disputed claim that he had, that if he felt that number was the wrong number, he had that dispute when he signed this release. And so, you know, that was the agreed entitlement going forward. That if we had tried, you know, he used the theft example. If somebody had subsequently stolen the money that was shown on that statement, he would obviously be able to pursue that and say, my statement said I'm entitled to X and I'm entitled to X. Mm-hmm. So,
but then you have this language. This is the last full paragraph of LaRue, and as I said, I'm interested in a more extended statement from both sides about this. But the last full paragraph of LaRue says that 502A2 does authorize recovery for fiduciary breaches, that's exactly what you just said he's suing for, that impair the value of plan assets in a participant's individual account. So that means, as I read it, that the plan assets are less than they should have been, and therefore this action for breach of fiduciary duty would allow a greater payout, if you will. You can call that benefits or whatever you want, but it sounds like benefits to me.
Well, Your Honor, again, LaRue says that it would allow a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. We believe that's a very different claim in nature from a claim for benefits under the plan. So if, with the Court's permission, I'd like to turn to the other appeal in this case, which is the 23F appeal from the grant of class certification in this case. As you know, the Court certified a class of all participants for whose individual accounts the Motorola 401k savings plan purchased and or held shares of common stock of Motorola at any time from May 16 to May 14 inclusive, except persons who signed valid releases of their claims, and also excluding individually named defendants in this action and current directors and officers of Motorola. We believe that the Court made at least three serious errors in certifying the class in that way. First, the Court ignored the fact that every one of the three representative plaintiffs has expressly disavowed the very first claim of the complaint.
You have all these excerpts from the depositions in your brief, but when you look at it in context, it seems to me maybe a more charitable reading of what these people were trying to say is that had Motorola been not been off, you know, financing the Uzan family in Turkey and the Telsim company, they had no problem with the idea that the Motorola plan was part of this operation. But, of course, as it was, they weren't happy with it.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't think that's what they're saying. In fact, in their depositions, which were held long after this time, they said that they still did not believe that there was any point that the plan should have been shut down or they should have been precluded from buying Motorola stock. What they were saying is, there's no question, they disagree, they challenge Motorola's business judgment in the dealings with Telsim. No dispute about that. That's obviously the case. And it seems clear that they also, at least in most instances, they also feel that there was insufficient disclosure of those dealings with Telsim. But that's the disclosure slash misrepresentation case. That is not the prudence case. The prudence case is that these problems became so severe that the Motorola stock fund was not an appropriate investment vehicle for the retirement plan anymore and should have been liquidated and further investment closed. There is absolutely no question. You cannot read the deposition testimony contrary to that.
But these are lay people talking. I mean, to attribute such profound legal significance to people who are obviously suing because they feel that the value of their assets in the overall plan was impaired by Motorola's handling of the plan seems to me going further than is justified. But let me ask you this question, because I know another one of your points has to do with manageability and the like. I'm not convinced that, particularly thinking of this as possibly a Rule 23C issues kind of class, that there isn't one big common issue, which I'm sure Motorola is prepared to say all this was business judgment, there was no fiduciary, I can imagine what the argument looks like, why that is not, in fact, a common issue for, as you say in your brief, at least everybody who didn't sign a release. We have this issue of valid releases, invalid releases that we also need to discuss, I think, but at least for the people who never signed a release, why isn't this a reasonable issues class?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it is the case that there are common issues here. That is not something we've disputed. We have disputed adequacy. We've disputed typicality because of the conflicts.
But there are no conflicts if you resolve the release issue.
I believe there are conflicts even if you don't, you know, even apart from the release issue. For example, we submitted the expert testimony of David Ross, who looked at the trading patterns and said that these groups could not ever agree on a date when the investment became imprudent, when it ceased to be imprudent, when it should have been shut down, when the stock should have been liquidated. There'd be wildly differing views.
Isn't that a matter for subclasses as opposed to throwing the whole class out?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because there's simply too many different alternatives to address in subclasses.
I would have thought that it was certainly the release issue, I thought very much the same, might be handled by subclasses. But in almost every case that's a class action, whether it's about a dangerous pharmaceutical product or whatever, you're going to wind up at the end of the day with individual hearings to see how much did this product damage person A versus person B. And at that stage, the plaintiffs recognize that maybe some people would wind up with nothing and maybe some people would wind up with a large recovery depending on what day they traded. But I'm not sure that deprives this of enough commonality for class treatment since we're on abusive discretion review anyway.
Well, and Your Honor, I think it's important to remember that in the pharmaceuticals context, you're typically talking about a 23B3 class, in which case there's a notice and opt-out, and here there is not that. So these are people who are bound to the determinations.
But you haven't challenged the B2B3 aspect of this, as I read your briefs. I was a little surprised that you didn't, actually.
The plaintiffs never sought certification under Rule 23B3. They sought certification under 23B1, 23B2. There was no discussion of 23B3.
Your brief does not go into the question whether this was properly thought of under B1 or B2. You focused on the 23A factors.
Your Honor, I think that's right. It was certified under 23B2, and if it were properly certifiable as a class, we don't necessarily dispute that 23B2 might be that. Now, it may not be that they could get all the relief they seek under 23B2. We're not necessarily disputing that 23B2 is the right vehicle for this kind of claim to the extent one could be asserted. In this case, we contend the conflicts are sufficiently great that you couldn't have a class at all. And we believe that the fact that there is no notice and opt-out is one more factor.
So what's the injunctive or declaratory relief that you think would come out of this? I realize I'm asking you a question against interest, but
Well, Your Honor, ERISA does allow other things, for example, removal of fiduciaries and various other things that might be something that the plaintiffs would want. Again, it's not my job to get the plaintiffs what they want out of this case, but we believe that these conflicts are serious. We believe that the releasers, because there is no releasor among the representative plaintiffs, we don't believe that it can be addressed by subclasses. That's a fundamental flaw. There is nobody here who has the incentive and the need to carry the flag for the releasers, so they should not be in this. And frankly, the very release issue under Pierce versus Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe is simply too fact-intensive, and there's too much uncertainty about who is even in the class. This is not about what everybody is entitled to at the end of the day. This is about whether people are in the class. And in fact,
our discussion of Mr. Howell's case makes me think that there might be some broad brush issues about the release itself, such as whether this is 410 or not, whether whether LaRue covers this kind of case. I mean, it seems to me there might be some very general questions, wholly apart from whether any particular person in the group was knowledgeable and had enough time to decide what they wanted to do and all those kinds of things.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are some possible outcomes of Mr. Howell's appeal that could change the dynamic of the releasers being in the class. But there are many outcomes that would not change that. For example, if the court found that Mr. Howell's release was not knowing and voluntary, that would not change the outcome. If the court finds that judgment was properly entered against Mr. Howell, it doesn't change the outcome. There are a number of different possibilities there, and they may have different impacts. But the fundamental point is that the determination whether potentially up to something like a third of the class is even in the class being reserved to a later date after thousands, tens of thousands of mini trials over the eight-factor Pierce test, we believe is inappropriate. And what's more,
why couldn't the district court, though, create a subclass and give the plaintiffs, you know, 30 days to come forward with somebody who can serve as a class, you know, I'd say a subclass representative? If they can't, then the subclass is out, and if they can, it's in.
Well, whether or not the court could do that, the court hasn't done that, and so this decision would still need to be reversed.
Interlocutory appeal. That's the joy of interlocutory appeals, unfortunately.
But the court clearly did not require that as a condition of the class it's certified, and so its decision is in error. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
I actually have a minute if you wanted, but that's all right.
Oh, I do have a minute?
Yes.
Well, I will say just one other point on the releaser question, and that is that another curious aspect of the court's ruling is that the releasers are actually provisionally excluded from the class. They are not provisionally included. And so there's this sort of bizarre heads you win, tails I lose aspect to this, that the defendants are in the position of having these people not bound by any judgment in its favor, but potentially able to come back in if there's a judgment against the defendants. And we believe that that's a further fundamental flaw with the decision. For all of those reasons, we believe that the Rule 23F appeal is well taken, that the class certification decision should be reversed, and that the court correctly decided the judgment as to Mr. Howell.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Mills?
My last word on the release issue is that Mr. Murray's argument that this is not a claim for benefits cannot possibly be squared with the language of the Guyton case, 489 F3rd, at 805. It just can't be squared with that. On class certification, we believe that Judge Pallmeyer did not abuse her discretion. She applied very well-established principles of class action jurisprudence in certifying the class.
But I'm very worried about this invalid release language in the description of the class, since I don't see how, look at Mr. Howell's appeal. I don't see how you can figure out which releases were valid and which were invalid without an individualized hearing on everybody who signed a release.
Well, as we know, and if it gets to post-liability stages, most of these big cases do settle. We may not have to get to it.
Well, but the Supreme Court very clearly told us in Amchem and Ortiz that we weren't supposed to approach class actions that way. We have to resolve the issues as they come along.
But I think both before and after the Supreme Court case, the jurisprudence is that individual questions such as this, which go to amount of damages, for example, class members.
They go to class membership, because if somebody really did sign a valid and binding release, they're not in the class, are they?
They would get no recovery. That's true.
They're not in the class. I mean, they're not a member of the class. And that's why I'm wondering whether, at a minimum, the district court erred by not requiring you to come forward with somebody who had signed a release to create a subclass, and maybe beyond that, I'm not sure what clean legal issue there is that you expect could be solved so that we know who belongs in and who belongs out of the releasing people. Can you summarize that?
Well, if this court finds that the carve-out language that I have been talking about all morning is controlling, and that's the same language used for everybody else, the release issue is gone. You don't have to contend with that. If the court's ruling is different, then we do have to contend with it, and the trial court does have to contend with it.
So in other words, you think there might be a theory under which none of the releases is valid?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. If the court finds that I am not releasing claims for benefits language is controlling, or that there's an ambiguity and holds it against Motorola, and this is the same form which was used, which it probably was, although I can't say I know that for a fact, then the release issue goes out of the case. We proceeded in the district court before Rule 23B1 and not B3 It possibly could be a B3 case as well. I think it satisfies the extra requirements under B3 are that it's the superior way to litigate and there are no impossible management issues. We probably could have proceeded under that, but under B1, we just fit the test that the case law, at least at the time, was predominantly that these are B1, proper B1 class actions.
That's with your focus on the plan itself.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
Don't you see some tension between this focus that you're trying to suggest on the plan and then on the other side, your argument that this is really about individual benefits for people like Mr. Howell or anyone else?
I don't think so, and I think we'll address the LaRue, but I think when I was reading LaRue, as I'm reading through it, I'm thinking, you know, this is starting to sound like a breach of duty claim. It's like an open market securities fraud purchaser claim. It's just an individual cause of action. But then you get to the end of the opinion, and the Supreme Court says, but you don't get the money. The recovery goes to the plan. It kind of brings it all back, you know, home to what a 502A2 claim is about. And I think that's kind of the final word, at least in my own mind.
Okay.
But I have nothing else. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. My thanks to both counsel. Our thanks. And we will take the cases under advisement.